The more I talk to him, the cuter he gets. I even like his earnestness, despite the fact that I usually hate earnestness. The sexy ponytail may be addling my brain. It's just hair, I tell myself. Its function is to keep the head warm and protect it against ultraviolet radiation. There's nothing inherently sexy about it.
What are we talking about again? He asks.
I say science at the same time that he says love. And we both laugh.
What are the ingredients?
He prompts me again. Mutual self-interest and socioeconomic compatibility.
Do you even have a soul?
No such thing as a soul, I say. He laughs at me as if I'm kidding.
Well, he says after he realizes that I'm not kidding, my ingredients are friendship, intimacy, moral compatibility, physical attraction, and the X factor.
What's the X factor?
Don't worry, he says. We already have it.
Good to know, I say, laughing. I'm still not going to fall in love with you.
Give me today.
He's suddenly serious. It's not a challenge, Daniel. He just stares at me with those bright brown eyes, waiting for an answer. You can have 1 hour, I say. He frowns.
Only an hour? What happens then? Do you turn into a pumpkin?
I have an appointment, and then I have to go home.
What's the appointment? He asks.
Instead of answering, I look around the cafe. A barista calls out a string of orders. Someone laughs. Someone else stumbles. I stir my coffee unnecessarily again. I'm not going to tell you, I say.
Okay,
he says, unfazed. He's made up his mind about what he wants, and what he wants is me. I get the feeling he can be determined and patient. I almost admire him for it, but he doesn't know what I know. I'll be a resident of another country tomorrow. Tomorrow, I'll be gone from here.
I show her my phone, and we argue over which questions to choose. We definitely don't have time for all 36. She wants to ixnay the 4 minutes of soulfully staring into each other's eyes, but that's not happening. The eye thing is my ace in the hole. All my ex-girlfriends... Okay, one of my ex-girlfriends. Okay, I've only ever had one girlfriend, now ex-girlfriend, have liked my eyes a lot. Grace, the aforementioned singular in the extreme ex-girlfriend, said they look like gemstones, specifically smoky quartz. Jewelry making was her hobby. We were making out in her room when she first said it, and she stopped mid-session to get an example for me. Anyway, my eyes are like quartz, the smoky kind. And girls, at least one, dig it. The questions fall into three categories, each more personal than the previous. Natasha wants to stick with the least personal ones from the first category, but I ixnay that as well. From category number one, least intimate, we choose number one, given the choice of anyone in the world, whom would you want as a dinner guest? Number two, would you like to be famous? In what way? Number seven, do you have a secret hunch about how you will die? From category number two, medium intimacy. Number 17, what is your most treasured memory? Number 24, how do you feel about your relationship with your mother? From category number three, most intimate. Number 25, make three true we statements each. For instance, we are both in this room feeling dot dot dot. Number 29, share with your partner an embarrassing moment in your life. Number 34, your house containing everything you own catches fire. After saving your loved ones and pets, you have time to safely make a final dash to save any one item. What would it be? Why? Number 35, of all the people in your family, whose death would you find most disturbing? Why? We end up with 10 questions because Natasha thinks that for number 24, we should talk about our relationship with both our mother and father. How come mothers are always the ones most blamed for screwing up children? Fathers screw up kids perfectly well. She says it like someone with first-hand experience. She checks the time on her phone again. I should go, she says, pushing her chair back and standing too quickly. The table wobbles. Some of her coffee splashes out. Shit, shit, she says. It's kind of an overreaction. I really want to ask about the appointment and her father, but I know better than to ask right now. I get up, grab some napkins, and clean up the spill. The look she gives me is somewhere between gratitude and exasperation. Let's get out of here, I say. Yeah, okay, thanks, she says. I watch as she navigates around the line of coffee-starved people to go outside. Probably I shouldn't stare at her legs, but they're great. The third greatest pair I've ever seen. I want to touch them almost as much as I want to keep talking to her, maybe a little more, but there are no circumstances under which she would let me do that. Either she's trying to shake me loose, or we are in a speed-walking competition that I'm unaware of. She dashes between a couple of slow walkers and skirts along the outside of sidewalk scaffolding to avoid having to slow down for people. Maybe I should give up. I don't know why I haven't yet. The universe is clearly trying to save me from myself. I bet if I look for signs about parting ways, I would find them. Where are we heading? I ask her when we come to a stop at a crosswalk. The haircut I'm supposed to be getting is going to have to wait. I'm pretty sure they let people with long hair go to college. I am heading uptown to my appointment, and you are tagging along with me. Yes, I am, I say, ignoring her not at all subtle emphasizing. We cross the street and walk along quietly for a few minutes. The morning settles into itself. A few stores have propped open their doors. The weather's too cold for air conditioning and too hot for closed doors. I'm sure my dad's done the same thing at our store. We pass the extraordinarily well-lit and extremely crowded window display of an electronics store. Every item in the display is tagged with a red "On Sale" sticker. There are hundreds of these stores all over the city. I can't understand how they stay in business. Who even shops in these? I wonder out loud. People who like to haggle, she says. Half a block later, we pass another, virtually identical store, and we both laugh. I take out my phone. So, you ready for these questions? You are relentless, she says, not looking at me. Persistent, I correct her. She slows down and looks over at me. Do you really think asking me deep, philosophical questions is going to make us fall in love? She puts air quotes. Oh, how I dislike air quotes around deep and philosophical and fall in love. Think of it as an experiment, I say. What'd you say before about the scientific method? This gets me a small smile. Scientists shouldn't experiment on themselves, she counters. Not even for the greater good, I ask, for furthering mankind's knowledge of itself? That gets me a big laugh.
Using science against me is pretty smart. Four observable facts. He's perfectly silly. And too optimistic and too earnest. And pretty good at making me laugh. Number one's too hard, he says. Let's start with question two. Would you like to be famous and how? You first, I tell him. I'd be a famous poet in chief. Of course he would. Observable fact, he's a hopeless romantic. You'd be broke, I tell him. Broke with money, but rich with words, he counters immediately. I'm going to vomit right here on the sidewalk. I say it too loudly and a woman in a suit gives us a wide berth. I'll clean you up, he says. Really, he's too sincere by half. What does a poet in chief even do? I ask. Offers wise and poetic counsel. I'd be the person world leaders came to with nasty philosophical problems. That you solve by writing them a poem? The skepticism in my voice cannot be missed. Or reading one, he says, with more unflappable sincerity. I make some gagging sounds. He bumps me lightly with his shoulder, and then steadies me with his hand on my back. I like the feel of his hand so much that I speed up a little to avoid it. You can be cynical all you want, but many a life can be saved by poetry, he says. I scour his face for a sign that he's joking, but no, he really does believe it, which is sweet. Also stupid, but mostly sweet. What about you? What kind of fame do you want? He asks. This is an easy one. I'd be a benevolent dictator. He laughs. Of any particular country? Of the whole world, I say, and he laughs some more. All dictators think they're benevolent, even the ones holding machetes. I'm pretty sure those ones know they're being greedy, murderous bastards. But you wouldn't be that, he asks. Nope. Pure benevolence from me. I would decide what was good for everyone and do it. But what if what's good for one person isn't good for another? I shrug. Can't please everyone. As my poet in chief, you could comfort the loser with a good poem. Touché, he says, smiling. He pulls out his phone again and begins thumbing through the questions. I take a quick look at my own phone. For a second, I'm surprised by the crack in the screen, until I remember my fall from earlier. What a day I'm having. Again, I'm thinking about multiverses and wondering about the ones where both my phone and headphones are still intact. There's a universe where I stayed home and packed like my mom wanted me to. My phone and headphones are fine, but I didn't meet Daniel. There's a universe where I went to school and am safely sitting in English class instead of almost being hit by a car. Again, no Daniel. In another Daniel-less universe, I did go to USCIS, but I didn't meet Daniel in the record store, so our chatting didn't have a chance to delay me. I arrived at the crosswalk before the BMW driver showed up, and there was no near-miss accident. My phone and headphones remain intact. Of course, there is an infinite number of these universes, including one where I did meet Daniel, but he wasn't able to save me at the crosswalk, and more than just my phone and headphones are broken. I sigh and check the distance to Attorney Fitzgerald's office. 12 more blocks. I wonder how much it will cost to fix my screen. But then, maybe I won't need to get it fixed. I'll probably need to get a new phone in Jamaica. Daniel interrupts my thoughts, and I'm kind of grateful. I don't want to think about anything having to do with leaving. All right, he says. Let's move on to number 7. What's your secret hunch about how you'll die? Statistically speaking, a black woman living in the United States is most likely to die at the age of 78 from heart disease. We come to another crosswalk, and he tugs me back from standing too close to the edge. His gesture and my response are so familiar, like we've done it many times before. He pinches my jacket at the elbow and tugs, just slightly. I back up toward him and indulge his protectiveness.
"So the heart's gonna get you then?" he asks.
I forget for a moment that we're talking about death. "Most likely," I say. "What about you?"
"Murder. Gas station or liquor store or someplace like that. Some guy with a gun will be robbing the place. I'll try to be a hero, but do something stupid like knock over the soda can pyramid, and that'll freak robber guy out, and what would have been your average stick-em-up will turn into a bloodbath. News at 11.
I laugh at him. "So, you're going to die an incompetent hero?"
"I'm going to die trying," he says,
and we laugh together. We cross the street. "This way," I tell him when he starts heading straight instead of right. "We need to go over to 8th. He pivots and grins at me like we're on an epic adventure.
"Hang on," he says, shrugging out of his jacket.
It seems weirdly intimate to watch as he takes it off, so I watch two very old, very cranky guys argue over a single cab a few feet from us. There are at least 3 other free cabs in the immediate vicinity. Observable fact. People aren't logical.
"Will this fit in your backpack?" he asks,
holding the jacket out to me. I know he's not asking me to wear it like I'm his girlfriend or something. Still, carrying his jacket strikes me as even more intimate than watching him take it off. "Are you sure?" I ask. "It'll get wrinkled."
"Doesn't matter," he says.
He guides me off to the side so we're not blocking the other pedestrians, and suddenly we're standing pretty close. I don't remember noticing his shoulders before. Were they this broad a second ago? I pull my eyes away from his chest and up to his face, but that's not any better for my equilibrium. His eyes are even clearer and browner in the sunlight. They are kind of beautiful. I slip my backpack off my shoulder and place it squarely between us so he has to back up a little. He folds the jacket neatly and puts it inside. His shirt is a crisp white, and the red tie stands out even more without his jacket on. I wonder what he looks like in regular clothes and what regular clothes are for him. No doubt jeans and a t-shirt, the uniform of all American boys everywhere. Is it the same for Jamaican boys? My mood turns somber at the thought. I don't want to start over again. It was hard enough when we first moved to America. I don't want to have to learn the rituals and customs of a new high school. New friends. New cliques. New dress codes. New hangouts. I scoot around him and start walking. Asian American men are most likely to die of cancer, I say. He frowns and double steps to catch up.
Really? I don't like that. What kind?
I'm not sure.
We should probably find out, he says.
He says we as if there's some future of us together, where our respective mortalities will matter to each other.
You really think you'll die of heart disease? He asks. Not something more epic?
Who cares about epic? Dead is dead. He just stares at me, waiting for an answer. Okay, I say. I can't believe I'm about to tell you this. I secretly think I'm going to drown.
Like in the open ocean? Saving someone's life or something?
In the deep end of a hotel pool, I say. He stops walking and pulls me off to the side again. A more considerate pedestrian there's never been. Most people just stop in the middle of the sidewalk.
Wait, he says. You can't swim?
I shrink my head down into my jacket. No. His eyes are searching my face and he's laughing at me without actually laughing.
But you're Jamaican. You grew up surrounded by water.
Island heritage notwithstanding, I can't swim.
I can tell he wants to make fun of me, but he resists.
I'll teach you, he says.
When?
Someday, soon. Could you swim when you lived in Jamaica? He asks.
Yep, but then we got here, and instead of the ocean, they had pools. I don't like chlorine.
You know they have salt water pools now.
That ship has sailed, I say. Now he does make fun of me.
What's your ship called? Girl who grew up on an island, which is a thing surrounded on all sides by water, can't swim? Because that would be a good name.
I laugh and thump him on the shoulder. He grabs my hand and holds my fingers. I try not to wish he could make good on his promise to teach me to swim.
I am a scholar compiling the Book of Natasha. Here's what I know so far. She's a science geek. She's probably smarter than me. Her fingers are slightly longer than mine and feel good in my hands. She likes her music angsty. She's worried about something having to do with her mysterious appointment. Tell me again why you're wearing a suit, she asks. I groan long and loud and with feeling.
Let's talk about God instead.
I get to ask questions too, she says. We walk single file underneath more sidewalk scaffolding. At any given moment, approximately 99, give or take, percent of Manhattan is under construction. I applied to Yale. I have an interview with an alum later. Are you nervous? She asks when we're side by side again.
I would be if I gave two shits.
But you only give one shit?
Maybe half a shit?
I say laughing. So your parents are making you do it. A sudden yelling from the street grabs our attention, but it's only one cab driver shouting at another. My parents are first-generation Korean immigrants, I say by way of explanation. She slows her walking and looks over at me.
I don't know what that means, she says.
I shrug. It means it doesn't matter what I want. I'm going to Yale. I'm going to be a doctor.
And you don't want that?
I don't know what I want, I say. From the look on her face, that was the worst thing I could say. She turns away from me and starts walking faster.
Well, you might as well be a doctor then.
What did I do just now? I ask, catching up to her. She waves me off. It's your life. I feel like I'm close to failing a test.
Well, what do you want to be when you grow up?
A data scientist? She says with no hesitation. I open my mouth to ask WTF, but she fills me in with a practiced speech. I'm not the first person to have WTF'd her career choice.
Data scientists analyze data, separate the noise from the signal, discern patterns, draw conclusions, and recommend actions based on the results.
Are computers involved?
Yes, of course, she says. There's a lot of data in this world.
That's so practical. Have you always known what you wanted to be? It's hard to keep the envy out of my voice. She stops walking again. At this rate, we'll never get where she's going.
This isn't destiny. I chose this career. It didn't choose me. I'm not fated to be a data scientist. There's a career section in the library at school. I did research on growing fields in the sciences, and ta-da! No fate or destiny involved, just research.
So it's not something you're passionate about? She shrugs and starts walking again.
It suits my personality, she says.
Don't you want to do something you love?
Why?
She asks, like she genuinely doesn't understand the appeal of loving something. It's a long life to spend doing something you're only meh about, I insist. We scoot around the combination pretzel-slash-hot-dog cart that already has a line. It smells like sauerkraut and mustard,
aka heaven. She wrinkles her nose. It's even longer if you spend it chasing dreams that can never, ever come true. Wait, I say. I put my hand on her arm to slow her down a little. Who says they can't come true? This earns me a sideways glance. Please, do you know how many people want to be actors or writers or rock stars? A lot. 99% of them won't make it. 0.9% of those left will make barely any money doing it. Only the last 0.1% make it big. Everybody else just wastes their lives trying to be them. Are you secretly my father? I ask. I sound like a 50-year-old Korean man? Without the accent. Well, he's just looking out for you. When you're a happy doctor making lots of money, you'll thank him that you didn't become some starving artist hating your day job and dreaming pointlessly about making it big. I wonder if she realizes how passionate she is about not being passionate. She turns to look at me, narrow-eyed. Please don't tell me you're serious about the poetry thing. God forbid, I say with mock outrage. We pass by a man holding a sign that says, "Please help, down on my luck." A cabbie on a mission honks long and loud at another cabbie, also on a mission. Are we really supposed to know what we want to do for the rest of our lives at the ripe old age of 17? Don't you want to know? She asks. She's definitely not a fan of uncertainty. I guess. I wish I could live 10 lives at once. She waves me off again. Ugh, you just don't want to choose. That's not what I mean. I don't want to get stuck doing something that doesn't mean anything to me. This track I'm on, it goes on forever. Yale, medical school, residency, marriage, children, retirement, nursing home, funeral home, cemetery. Maybe it's because of the importance of the day. Maybe it's meeting her. But right now it's crucial to say exactly what I mean. We have big, beautiful brains. We invent things that fly. Fly! We write poetry. You probably hate poetry, but it's hard to argue with. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. In terms of sheer beauty, we are capable of big lives, a big history. Why settle? Why choose the practical thing, the mundane thing? We are born to dream and make the things we dream about. It all comes out more passionately than I intend, but I mean every word. Our eyes meet. There's something between us that wasn't there a minute ago. I wait for her to say something flip, but she doesn't. The universe stops and waits for us. She opens her palm, and she's going to take my hand. She's supposed to take my hand. We're meant to walk through this world together. I see it in her eyes. We are meant to be. I'm certain of this in a way I'm not certain about anything else. But she doesn't take my hand. She walks on.
We are having a moment I don't want to be having. When they say the heart wants what it wants, they're talking about the poetic heart, the heart of love songs and soliloquies, the one that can break as if it were just formed glass. They're not talking about the real heart, the one that only needs healthy foods and aerobic exercise. But the poetic heart is not to be trusted. It is fickle and will lead you astray. It will tell you that all you need is love and dreams. It will say nothing about food and water and shelter and money. It will tell you that this person, the one in front of you, the one who caught your eye for whatever reason, is the one. And he is, and she is, the one. For right now, until his heart or her heart decides on someone else or something else. The poetic heart is not to be trusted with long-term decision-making. I know all these things. I know them the way I know that Polaris, the North Star, is not actually the brightest star in the sky. It's the 50th. And still here I am with Daniel, in the middle of the sidewalk, on what is almost certainly my last day in America. My fickle, non-practical, non-future-considering, nonsensical heart wants Daniel. It doesn't care that he's too earnest, or that he doesn't know what he wants, or that he's harboring dreams of being a poet, a profession that leads to heartbreak and the poorhouse. I know there's no such thing as meant to be, and yet here I am, wondering if maybe I've been wrong. I close my open palm, which wants to touch him, and I walk on.
Love, a chemical history. According to scientists, there are three stages of love: lust, attraction, and attachment. And it turns out each of the stages is orchestrated by chemicals, neurotransmitters in the brain. As you might expect, lust is ruled by testosterone and estrogen. The second stage, attraction, is governed by dopamine and serotonin. When, for example, couples report feeling indescribably happy in each other's presence, that's dopamine, the pleasure hormone, doing its work. Taking cocaine fosters the same level of euphoria. In fact, scientists who study both the brains of new lovers and cocaine addicts are hard-pressed to tell the difference. The second chemical of the attraction phase is serotonin. When couples confess that they can't stop thinking about each other, it's because their serotonin level is dropped. People in love have the same low serotonin levels as people with OCD. The reason they can't stop thinking about each other is that they are literally obsessed. Oxytocin and vasopressin control the third stage, attachment, or long-term bonding. Oxytocin is released during orgasm and makes you feel closer to the person you've had sex with. It's also released during childbirth and helps bond mother to child. Vasopressin is released postcoitally. Natasha knows these facts cold. Knowing them helped her get over Rob's betrayal. So she knows love is just chemicals and coincidence. So why does Daniel feel like something more?
There are exactly no items on the list of things I want to do less than go to my interview. And yet, it's almost 11 a.m., and if I'm going to go to this thing, then I need to get gone. Natasha and I have been walking along in silence ever since the moment. I wish I could say it's a comfortable silence, but it isn't. I want to talk to her about it, the moment, but who knows if she even felt it. No way does she believe in that stuff. Midtown Manhattan is different from where we first met. More skyscrapers and fewer souvenir shops. The people act different, too. They're not tourists out for pleasure or shopping. There's no excitement or gawking or smiling. These people work in these skyscrapers. I'm pretty sure my appointment is somewhere in this neighborhood. We keep walking and not talking until we get to a giant concrete and glass monstrosity of a building. It amazes me that people spend their entire days inside places like this doing things they don't love for people they don't like. At least being a doctor will be better than that. "This is where I'm going," she says. "I can wait for you out here," I say, like a person who doesn't have an appointment that will determine his future in just over an hour. "Daniel," she says, using the stern voice she's sure to use on our future children. She'll definitely be the disciplinarian. "You have an interview and I have this thing. This is where we say goodbye." She's right. I may not want the future my parents have planned for me, but I don't have any better ideas. If I stay here much longer, my train will derail from its track. It occurs to me that maybe that's what I want.
Maybe all the things I'm feeling for Natasha are just excuses to make it derail. After all, my parents would never approve. Not only is she not Korean, she is black. There's no future here. That and the fact that my extreme like for her is clearly unrequited. And love is not love if it's not requited, right? I should go. I'm going to go. I'm getting gone. You're right, I say. She's surprised, and maybe even a little disappointed, but what difference does that make? She has to want this, and clearly she does not.
I wasn't expecting him to say that, and I didn't expect to feel disappointed, but I do. Why am I thinking about romance with a boy I'll never see again? My future gets decided in 5 minutes. We're standing close enough to the building's sliding glass doors that the cool of the air conditioning washes over my skin as people enter and exit. He sticks out his hand for a shake, but quickly pulls it back. "Sorry," he says and blushes. He folds his arms across his chest. "Well, I'm going," I say. "You're going," he says, and then neither of us moves. We stand there not saying anything for another few seconds, until I remember I still have his jacket in my backpack. I take it out and watch as he shrugs it back on. "In that suit, you look like you should work in this building," I say to him. I mean it as a compliment, but he doesn't take it as one. He tugs at his tie and grimaces. "Maybe I will one day." "Well," I say, after more staring and not talking, "this is getting awkward.
Should we just hug?"
"I thought you suits only shook hands." I'm trying to keep my tone light, but my vocal cords go all husky and weird. He smiles and doesn't try to keep any of the sadness off his face. How can he be so okay with showing off his heart? I have to look away from him. I don't want whatever is happening between us to happen, but it feels like trying to stop the weather from happening. The doors open and the cool air washes over my skin again. I'm hot and cold at the same time. I open my arms for a hug at the same time he does. We try to hug each other from the same side and end up bumping chests instead. We laugh awkwardly and stop moving.
"I'm going to go right," he says. "You go left."
"Okay," I say, and go left. He holds me. And since we're both about the same height, my face brushes against his cheek, which is soft and smooth and warm. I let my head drop onto his shoulder and my body relaxes in his arms. For a minute I let myself feel how tired I am. It's hard trying to hold on to a place that doesn't want you. But Daniel does want me. I feel it in the way he holds me tight. I pull out of his arms and don't meet his eyes. He decides not to say whatever he was going to say. I get out my phone and check the time.
"Time to go," he says before I can say it first.
I turn and walk into the cold building. I think about him as I sign in with security. I think about him as I cross the lobby floor. I think about him in the elevator and down the long hallway. And every moment until the moment that I have to stop thinking about him when I enter the office. The construction noises I heard over the phone earlier were actually due to construction, because the office is only halfway built. The walls are partly painted and bare bulbs hang from the ceiling. Sawdust and paint splotches cover the tarped floor. Behind the desk, a woman sits with both hands resting on her office phone, as if she's willing it to ring. Despite her bright red lipstick and rose-rouged cheeks, she's very pale. Her hair is deep black and perfectly styled. Something about her doesn't seem quite real. She seems like she's playing a part, an extra from an old-school Disney cartoon, or from a period movie set in the 1950s that called for secretaries. Her desk is neat, with color-coded stacks of files. There's a mug that says, "Paralegals do it cheaper." She smiles a sad, trembling smile as I approach. "Do I have the right place?" I ask out loud. She stares at me mutely. "Is this Attorney Fitzgerald's office?" I prompt. "You're Natasha," she says. She must be the person I spoke with earlier. I approach the desk. "I have some bad news," she says. My stomach clenches. I'm not ready for what she's going to say. Is it over before it's even begun? Has my fate already been decided? Am I really being deported tonight? A man in paint-splattered overalls walks in and starts drilling. Someone else I can't see begins hammering. She doesn't change her volume to adjust for the noise. I move even closer to the desk. "Jeremy, Attorney Fitzgerald, was in a car accident an hour ago. He's still in the hospital. His wife says he's fine, just a few bruises. But he won't be back until late this afternoon." Her voice sounds normal, but her eyes are anything but. She pulls the phone a little closer and looks at it instead of me. "But we have an appointment now." My whine is uncharitable, but I can't help it. I really need him to help me. Now she does look at me, eyes wide and incredulous. "Didn't you hear what I said? He was hit by a car. He can't be here right now." She pushes a sheaf of forms at me and doesn't look at me again. It takes me at least 15 minutes to fill out the paperwork. On the first form, I answer several variations on the questions of whether I'm a communist, a criminal, or a terrorist, and whether I would take up arms to defend the United States. I would not, but still, I check the box that says yes. Another form asks for details about what's happened in the deportation process so far. The final form is a client questionnaire that asks me to give a full accounting of my time in the United States. I don't know what to say. I don't know what Attorney Fitzgerald is looking for. Does he want to know how we entered the country? How we hid? How it feels every time I write down my fake Social Security number on a school form? How every time I do, I picture my mom getting on that bus to Florida? Does he want to know how it feels to be undocumented? Or how I keep waiting for someone to find out I don't belong here at all? Probably not. He's looking for facts, not philosophy, so I write them down. We traveled to America on a tourist visa. When it came time for us to leave, we stayed. We have not left the country since. We have committed no crimes except for my dad's DUI. I hand her back the forms and she flips immediately to the client questionnaire. "You need more here," she says. "Like what?" "What does America mean to you? Why do you want to stay? How will you contribute to making America greater? Is that really..." "Anything Jeremy can use to humanize you will help," she says. "If people who were actually born here had to prove they were worthy enough to live in America, this would be a much less populated country." She flips through my other forms as I write about what a hard-working, optimistic, patriotic citizen I would be. I write that America is my home in my heart, and how citizenship will legalize what I already feel. I belong here. In short, I'm more sincere than I'm ever comfortable being. Daniel would be proud of me. Daniel. He's probably on a train on his way to his appointment. Will he do the proper thing and become a doctor after all? Will he think of me in the future and remember the girl he spent 2 hours with one day in New York? Will he wonder whatever happened to me? Maybe he'll do a Google search using only my first name and not get very far. More likely, though, he'll forget about me by this evening, as I will certainly forget about him. The phone rings as I write, and she grabs it before it has a chance to ring twice. Oh, my God, Jeremy, are you all right? She closes her eyes, cradles the phone with both hands, and presses it close to her face. I wanted to come, but your wife said I should hold down the fort. Her eyes flick open when she says the word wife. Are you sure you're okay? The more she listens, the brighter she becomes. Her face flushes and her eyes shine with happy tears. She's so obviously in love with him, I expect to see heart bubbles floating around the room. Are they having an affair? I wanted to come, she whispers again. After a series of murmured okays, she hangs up the phone. He's all right, she beams. Her whole body is aglow with relief. That's great, I say. She takes the forms from my hands. I wait as she reads through them. Would you like to hear some good news? She asks. Of course I would. I nod slowly. I've seen lots of cases like this, and I think you'll be okay. I don't know what I was expecting her to say, but certainly not this. You really think he'll be able to help? I can hear the hope and skepticism in my own voice. Jeremy never loses, she says, so proudly that she could be talking about herself. But of course, that can't be true. Everyone loses something sometime. I should ask her to be more precise, to give me an exact win-loss ratio, so I can decide how to feel. There's hope, she says simply. Even though I hate poetry, a poem I read for English class pops into my head. Hope is a thing with feathers. I understand concretely what that means now. Something inside my chest wants to fly out, wants to sing and laugh and dance with relief. I thank her and leave the office quickly before I can ask her something that takes away this feeling. Usually I fall on the side of knowing the truth, even if the truth is bad. It's not the easiest way of being. Sometimes the truth can hurt more than you expect. A few weeks ago, my parents were arguing in their bedroom with the door closed. It was one of those rare occasions when my mom actually got angry with my dad to his face. Peter found me eavesdropping outside their door. After they were done arguing, I asked him if he wanted to know what I'd heard, but he didn't. He said he could tell that whatever I learned was bad, and he didn't really want any badness in his life just then. At the time, I was annoyed with him, but later I thought maybe he'd been right. I wished I could unhear what I'd overheard. Back in the hallway, I leaned my forehead against the wall and hesitate. I debate going back into the office to press her for more details, but decide against it. What good will it do? I might as well wait for the official word from the lawyer. Besides, I'm tired of worrying. I know that what she said is not a guarantee, but I need to feel something other than resigned dread. Hope seems like a good substitute. I consider calling my parents to tell them about this new development, but then I don't do that either. I have no new information to share. What would I say? A man I don't know has sent me to see another man I don't know? A paralegal who is not a lawyer, whom I also don't know, says everything might be all right? What's the use in getting all our hopes up? The person I really want to talk to is Daniel, but he's long gone to his interview. I wish I'd been nicer to him. I wish I'd gotten his phone number. What if this immigration nonsense resolves itself? If I get to stay, how will I find him again? Because no matter how much I pretended it didn't exist, there was something between us. Something big.
Hannah Winter, A Fairy Tale History, Part 1. Hannah has always thought of herself as living in a fairy tale where she's not the star. She's neither the princess nor the fairy godmother, neither the high evil witch nor her familiar. Hannah is a minor character, illustrated for the first time on page 12 or 13. The cook, perhaps, presiding over crumpets and sugar plums. Or maybe she's the handmaiden, good-natured and just out of view. It wasn't until she met and started working for attorney Jeremy Fitzgerald that she imagined she could become the star. In him, she recognized her one true love, her happily ever after. This despite the fact that he is a married man, despite the fact that he's a father to two young children. Hannah never believed he would love her back until the day he did just that. That day is today. Attorney Jeremy Fitzgerald, A Fairy Tale History, Part 1. Jeremy Fitzgerald was crossing the street when a drunk and distraught man, an insurance actuary, in a white BMW hit him at 20 miles per hour. The blow wasn't enough to kill him, but it was enough to make him consider his eventual death and his current life. It was enough to make him admit to himself that he was in love with his paralegal, Hannah Winter, and that he had been for some time now. At some point later today, when he returns to his office, he will wordlessly take Hannah into his arms. He will hold her and wonder very briefly about the future that loving her will cost him.
Area teenager chooses poorly. My mother, the pacifist, would kill me dead if she knew what I'd just done. I rescheduled my interview. For a girl. Not even a Korean girl. A black girl. A black girl I don't really know. A black girl I don't really know who might not even like me. The woman on the phone said my timing was perfect. She'd been about to call me to reschedule as well. The only appointment I could get is for late in the day, 6 p.m., so here I am in the lobby of the building where I left Natasha, reading the directory and keeping an eye out for her. Most of the tenants of this building are lawyers, J.D., Esquire, and accounting types, CPA, CFA, etc. I've never seen so many degree abbreviations in my life. Daniel J. Hobay, F.B., Foolish Boy, D.T.F., Doomed to Failure. What appointment could she possibly have in this building? Either she's an heiress with money to invest, or she's in trouble and needs a lawyer to help her. Across the lobby, the elevator doors open and she walks out. When I was rescheduling my appointment, part of me wondered if I was being ridiculous. A girl I've just met isn't worth jeopardizing my future over. It was easier to have that thought when I wasn't looking at her, because now I can't remember why I hesitated at all. Of course she's worth it, and I can't explain it. Yes, she's pretty. The combination of her big hair and bright black eyes and full pink lips is undeniably cute. Also, she has the nicest legs that exist in the known world. I moved them up to number 1 from number 3 after careful study. I'm being objective here. So yes, I'm definitely attracted to her. But there's something else, too. And I'm not just saying that because she has the nicest legs in the known universe. Objectively speaking. I watch as she makes her way across the lobby. She's looking around, trying to find something or someone. Her shoulders literally sag when she doesn't find it.
She's gotta be looking for me, right? Unless she met another potential love of her life in the 30 minutes she was away from me.
Outside, she does a slow 360 one way, and then a slower 360 the other way. Whoever she's looking for is still not there.
He's not in the lobby, and he's not outside in the courtyard. I have to admit that he's not here and that I wanted him to be. My stomach feels a little hollow, like I'm hungry, but food is not what I want. The day's gotten warmer. I take off my jacket, fold it over my forearm, and stand there trying to decide what to do next. I'm reluctant to leave, and reluctant to admit to myself that I don't want to leave. It's not that I think we were meant to be, or anything ridiculous like that. But it would have been nice to spend the next few hours with him. It might have been nice to go on a date with him. I would have liked to know if he blushes when he kisses. This is the last place I saw him. If I leave, then I have no chance of seeing him again. I wonder how his interview is going. Is he saying the right things? Or is he letting all his doubt and existential angst shine through? The boy needs a life coach. I'm about to go when something makes me take a final look around. I know it's not possible to feel a specific person's presence. More than likely, my subconscious spotted him as I was walking through the lobby. People use poetic language to describe things they don't understand. Usually there's a scientific explanation if you only look for it. Anyway, there he is. He is here.
She's walking toward me. A couple of hours ago, I would have said that her face was expressionless, but I am becoming a Natasha expert, and her face is only trying to be expressionless. If I had to guess, I would say that she's happy to see me. "What happened to your interview?" she asks as soon as she's close enough. No hug. No, "I'm so happy to see you." Maybe I'm not such a Natasha expert after all. Do I go with the facts or the truth? Curiously, these are not always the same. The fact is, I postponed. The truth is, I postponed so I could spend more time with her. I go with the truth. I postponed so I could spend more time with you.
Are you insane? This is your life we're talking about.
I didn't burn the building to the ground, Tosh. I just moved it until later. Who is Tosh? She asks. But there's a smile at the corner of her lips. How did your thing go? I point my chin in the direction of the elevators. Her smile goes away. Note to self, do not bring this up again. Fine. I have to come back at 3:30. I look at my phone. 11:35 a.m. Looks like we have more time together, I say. I expect her to roll her eyes, but she doesn't. I take it as a small victory. She shivers a little and rubs her hands down her forearms. I can see the goosebumps on her skin, and now I've learned another thing about her. She gets cold easily. I take her jacket and help her into it. She slides one arm in, and then the other, and then shrugs to adjust the shoulders. I help her with the collar. It's a small thing. I let my hand rest on the back of her neck, and she leans back into me just slightly. Her hair tickles my nose. It's a small thing, but it feels like something we've been doing for a long time now. She turns, and I have to lift my hand so I don't touch her more intimately. Wherever we're going, we're not there yet. "Are you sure you're not jeopardizing?" she begins. "I don't actually care." "You should care." She stops talking and looks up at me with restless eyes. "You did it for me?" "Yes." What makes you so sure I'm worth it?
Instinct, I say. I don't know what it is about.